Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, you know what?
No.
It's morning. It's cool. It's cool out, man.
It's cooler.
Cool. Cool. It's like cooler. Hey, this is KBOO 90.7 your FM dial. My name's Joe Uris. That's Abe Proctor. This is Talk Radio, and the number to call 231-8187. How's the war in your neighborhood? Never mind. Let's talk about stem cells.
It has been hot. You're right. I was in the world's longest wedding over the weekend.
The world's longest wedding?
Well,
just that's the one where you stand up and sit down a lot, and
well, no,
and
it wasn't that
the
long.
The priest warns how 9/10 of all marriages don't end in anything disaster. And
right. Well, it was long because I had a tuxedo on, and it was about 105.
You had a tuxedo on?
Yeah.
I'm so sorry I missed that.
I'm sure.
You know.
It's murder, says the president, to do research with stem cells.
Yeah. You know, wait. You got to understand now. I think you're not sympathetic enough. I mean, there's this little, these little zygotes, these little, you know, like four cells, six cells, whatever. You know, they're thinking. They're thinking all the time. They're at least as smart as the president.
Well, at least, yeah. But apparently it's murder to use those embryos for research, but not murder just to throw them in the trash.
Well, yeah.
So, I suppose that's
makes perfect sense, that.
Logically consistent. So there was a very interesting interview on Tim Russert's show over the weekend with White House Chief of Staff Josh Bolton, in which he bobbed and weaved and shucked and jived and tried to do everything he possibly could to make logical sense out of the president's position, but couldn't do it. It was pretty funny. And he ended up saying what a shame it was that all 400,000 existing embryos at fertility clinics around the country are not going to be adopted. And what a tragedy that was.
Take home your own little Petri dish.
Yeah, that's right. So, that's the tragedy. Not that we're going to, you know, figure out a way to cure all sorts of diseases and, you know, genetic defects and all those sorts of things. But
I think it's just great. Yeah. I think the United States is, under the brilliant leadership of this administration, is moving rapidly into the early Middle Ages.
Yes, they are. A glorious march backward.
I think
drums
so.
Beating, flags
I got
waving.
Ready. They were in a crusade, you know.
That's right.
It's cool.
Well, yeah, as we just heard on the KBOO Morning News, the European Union has decided they're going to go full speed ahead with embryonic stem cell research.
Well, of course they are.
And we're going to lose a bunch of really good minds.
And money.
It reminds me of a similar period where Europe lost a bunch of really good minds, only they came here.
Yeah. That was a long time ago.
Fascism there.
Yeah.
I don't know. Ironic, maybe?
No, yes. Not even. It's not even ironic. It's like
dumb.
Yeah, stupid.
Okay. So, yeah.
Sad. Hey, you know, we got Melanie Sloan.
Melanie Sloan's going to be in today.
Yeah, well, you got her back. I'm glad.
Yeah, me too. I like her. She's a good guest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Washington, D.C., all that.
Sure. So, yeah, let's have a moment of silence for the 400,000 embryos that won't be adopted. Okay.
That was it.
So what did you want to talk about today?
Well, I guess we have to talk about the disproportionate response of Israel to the outrages of Hezbollah. You know, last week I did what maybe some people felt was tedious, others felt probably was useful, discussion, and by no means a complete discussion, I want to be clear of that, about that, of the history of the relationships in the Israel-Palestine struggle. One thing I think I said that I want to make sure everyone understands, probably most of our listeners do, Hezbollah is essentially a creation of the Israeli invasion and occupation of southern Lebanon, in fact, all of Lebanon, and, in other words, didn't exist before then, and Hamas is essentially the creation of Israel's continued repression and land taking from what survives of the Palestinian non-state.
So, in the Golan Heights.
Yeah,
region.
Yeah.
Okay.
So essentially you have this situation which is virtually a self-fulfilling disaster. We now have an administration in Washington, D.C., which seems to be thinking that what Israel does in this situation serves it. You know, Israel's like a client state for the war on terrorism. Terrorism seems to equal everybody in Lebanon.
Well, terrorism seems to equal everyone who's convenient.
Well, something. I mean, anyway, it's just, I mean, to me, it's all very, very tragic and very horrible and very indefensible on the part of Israel and the United States.
All right, well, to play devil's advocate for a moment, was not the Lebanese state harboring a very organized paramilitary organization, Hezbollah, and
well,
allowing it to carry out...
Harboring is an interesting term. Hezbollah functions in much the same way as Hamas in Palestine, in that it provides... its base is popular support because it provides education, hospitals, medical care, social services, housing, any number of valued and needed services to the people of Lebanon, particularly southern Lebanon, but also in some neighborhoods in Beirut. Hezbollah is a political party. It is also an organization that engages in terrorist activity. So it's very, very complex. Same is true of Hamas. And it has its roots in the sense of injustice that I think is valid on the part of the Palestinian people, but also on the part of other Arab peoples in the region. And probably more important than that, Hamas, as a military or paramilitary organization, is the only Arab force that has ever defeated Israel in the field. So it has a certain kind of macho status in that region.
Have they defeated Israel in an actual battle?
Are you talking about
managing to survive and hang on?
Well, no. I mean, they were largely responsible for the constant... Israel's situation in Lebanon in the 80s is not unlike the situation of the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, that is, or the United States in Vietnam. There was a constant war going on. They could occupy but not really hold land. The casualty rates kept on and on and on and on. It was what's now called asymmetrical warfare. And eventually Israel decided to get the hell out. And it was therefore a victory, by any interpretation, by Hezbollah. So that's the situation. Now Hezbollah is doing the same thing again. Doesn't seem to mind taking a lot of casualties, particularly since most of the casualties seem to be civilians unrelated directly to Hezbollah. And the result is that the whole Arab world, not the leadership of the various corrupt nations that are part of the Arab League, but the whole Arab world is very, very sympathetic to Hezbollah and increasingly unsympathetic to already hated Israel.
And I think much of the rest of the world as well.
Well, it's the disproportionateness of the Israeli response. Bombing Beirut... virtual ethnic cleansing of southern Lebanon. I mean, this is horrendous stuff.
It's what amounts to a de facto invasion.
Well, yeah. And they claim they're not going to occupy territory. First, they said they weren't going to go in more than a few hundred yards, and they said they weren't going to go past whatchamacallit river. I mean, I don't know. Meanwhile, the U.S. is deliberately egging them on and saying it won't interfere until some kind of peace can be worked out that will be permanent. In other words, essentially, from the U.S. point of view, Hezbollah must disappear. Now, Hezbollah has legitimacy beyond the fact that it is serving the people of Lebanon, and certainly legitimacy beyond the fact that it's a thorn, big thorn, in the side of Israel. Hezbollah also is part of the legitimate government. That is, it has seats in the government of, and in the cabinet, in fact, of the very difficult to cobble together Lebanese government.
Which is a democratically elected government, it must be said.
Well, yeah, and the same, by the way, is true for the Palestinian government. You know, Hamas did not intend, from what I understand, to win. They were unprepared for this situation of actually governing. And their win is an ironic thing in that they were much more popular than they themselves realized.
Well, it doesn't matter whether or not they were prepared to win. Since they have won, they really have not been allowed to govern.
Right.
The Israeli government has systematically hindered every attempt that the Hamas has made to actually govern the Palestinian territories with the support of the United States.
Well, in fact, Israel takes the position that since Hamas, a lot of the people elected from the Hamas party, and similarly Hezbollah, are people who have actively engaged in terrorism against Israel, that they are criminals and they will be grabbed or shot or blown up or whatever by Israel at Israel's whim and will and opportunity. With that point of view, there's no possibility of negotiation from the perspective of Hamas or Hezbollah. Now, that's weird. But if you consider the whole longer history of the region, you suddenly realize that the creation of the State of Israel was also accomplished through terrorism.
Yeah.
And I suppose, if you want to extend that kind of analogy, the creation of the United States, from the point of view of the English, was created through terrorism.
Right.
Except, of course, that I don't think in the American Revolution there was the pattern of attacking relatively innocent or completely innocent civilian targets.
There was the tea incident.
The Boston Tea Party?
Right.
Well, I hardly would. That's kind of wimpy compared to the horrible stuff that's being done in the Middle East today.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM. 231-8187 is the number to call. That's Joe.
I'm Joe.
And I'm Abe.
He's Abe.
And we're talking about, as we usually do, a whole hodgepodge of things.
Well, didn't we have a third topic you wanted to talk about?
We do.
Before we open the lines up, let's get it out there.
Well, I hope we're not done with this.
Oh, no, I don't think so.
Okay, good, because there's some good stuff there.
You know what I didn't hear last week? I didn't hear a Zionist voice on our station. And I'm a little disappointed at that. I don't know if that means that Zionists don't listen to us or they don't call in.
It could very well be that Zionists don't listen to us.
Well, but I think it's important. I think it's important that that position, though I don't agree with it in large part, be represented. I also think it's important to discuss, if we're going to discuss this issue, how the state of Israel, which is a reality, can survive. Because I believe it needs to survive in the region. I think because it's a reality, it has the right to exist as any state does. And this is a very difficult situation in which I think Israel has essentially put itself in a position where only by the force of the United States and the convenience of geopolitics does it get to exist at all.
Yeah, that's true. All right, so we'll talk about this other thing.
Yeah, what's this other thing?
Despite the lamentable state of popular journalism in this country, there are nonetheless some good investigative reporters out there doing some very good work. Cy Hirsch with The New Yorker, Ron Susskind, who's writing books rather than articles. Also, Charlie Savage from the Boston Globe, who came out a couple months ago with a wonderful piece about how President Bush has been using signing statements appended to pieces of legislation as a sort of veto light. Only obeying.
Well, what's the signing statement?
A signing statement. We talked about this.
Yeah.
You know,
this is for the audience when I say those
for
questions.
For the audience.
It's not like really know.
Well, for all those people like... who are not in this room. Okay. The dozens of people not in this room. A signing statement is something that President Bush has used when a piece of legislation comes across his desk and he signs it. He has literally hundreds of times simultaneously issued a presidential signing statement saying, well, this is what I think the law means, and these are the parts of it that I will enforce or not enforce, and here's how I'm going to do it. So essentially it's been a sort of a executive fiat, the president deciding unilaterally what the Congress does or does not mean with its legislation.
So it's presidential nullification.
Yeah, exactly.
No more separation of powers.
Right, exactly. So as we know, the president, until he decided to bravely stand up for the 400,000 unadopted embryos, had not yet used his veto power. Instead, he's issued, I think, going on almost 800 of these signing statements.
Sneaky little sucker, isn't he?
Oh, yeah, he is a sneaky little sucker. And it's been some pretty serious stuff. Like he decided that he was going to go ahead and continue with some of the various illegal spying programs he has embarked upon, regardless of what the Congress has said. A whole bunch of pieces of legislation with direct relation to the war on terror that he has said he was going to continue to enforce in his own fashion. But anyway, that's what Mr. Savage at the Boston Globe has reported on very eloquently in the past. But he just came out with another investigative report, this one on the way the Bush administration has transformed the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division into a body that essentially supports conservative positions. In the past, the Civil Rights Division at the Department of Justice has been staffed with career attorneys with an interest, an abiding interest in civil rights, meaning these are not political appointees. These are people who are dedicating their legal careers to the pursuit of racial, gender, religious equality, to civil rights. But that's changed. Savage reports of 45 lawyers hired since 2003. 11 were members of the Federalist Society. 7 were members of the Republican National Lawyers Association. 6 claimed membership in conservative Christian groups. And several more worked previously for conservatives like Ken Starr, Ed Meese, and Trent Lott. So, in the 2 years before former Attorney General John Ashcroft changed the hiring procedures at the department, or in the office, 77% of the lawyers who got jobs there had previous civil rights experience. That has dropped to 42%, and more than half of those, quote, gained their experience either by defending employers against discrimination lawsuits or by fighting against race-conscious policies. And Savage concludes that this has had the effect of, he says, the division is bringing fewer voting rights and employment cases involving systematic discrimination against African Americans and more alleging reverse discrimination against whites and religious discrimination against Christians. So essentially, the Civil Rights Office has been transformed to represent civil rights as the Bush administration and conservatives define them.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, finally Bush accepted the invitation of the NAACP and got a very cold reception there. The story you're talking about is but one example of this administration's bad behavior. But another example is the fact that we have now a minimum wage, which is in real dollars the equivalent of the minimum wage in 1955. And unfortunately in this country, minority people are a disproportionate part of that group which get minimum wages. So from the point of view of an African-American family, these are really bad times. Under the Clinton years, and I'm no big fan of Clinton, but under the Clinton years, the fact of the matter was that the wages of all Americans, particularly at the bottom end, but at all ends, went up. And now they're gone down.
Yep.
Republicans bunch the money at the top.
That's what they do.
They also make war. My father used to say Democrats make war, Republicans bunch the money. He was wrong. These Republicans make war and bunch the money. Really, double bad.
And Democrats run around going, woe is me, woe is me.
What to do, what to do.
Oh, dear. Triumph.
Should we go to a lot of these phone calls?
Yes, we should.
All right, 231-8187.
Hey, Eduardo, who do we have this morning? I guess we're not going to the calls.
Eduardo's busy having a serious conversation over there.
Okay. So...
Oh, yeah, Eduardo, hello. Let's take a call. Who do we got? We're going to do this.
Yeah, we are.
I think so.
Yeah, this is talk radio.
Hello, let's take a call. Who do we got?
Hey, we're hearing ourselves on delay in our headphones. This is a very surreal sort of experience. Okay, well, we'll go back to that when we
get the glitch. Yeah, that's kind of cool. It's good playing catch-up out there.
Okay.
Catch-up, you know, catch-up is actually originally a... Cantonese word.
Oh.
Kautsup.
Yeah, thank you for that.
I made that up.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, maybe I didn't. I can't remember.
All right, so as with the war in Iraq, the big winners in this conflict between Israel and Lebanon appear to be the Iranians.
Well, of course. Isn't that the whole goal, to make the Iranians the winners and the U.S. the losers?
Yeah, isn't it?
Is it? I'm totally confused. You know, I can't. Why do you mean the Iranians?
Okay, well, in Iraq... the violence in Iraq is more and more kind of distilling itself down into to a conflict between Shia and Sunni Muslims.
Yes.
This is an ages-old schism, roughly analogous to the Protestant-Catholic split in Christianity. Been fighting each other for a long, long time and didn't under the administration of Saddam Hussein, but are now once again doing so.
Yeah.
Iran, a neighboring nation of Iran, is a majority Shiite nation whose clergy exhibit wield a great deal of influence over Shiites in neighboring nations, including those in Iraq. In fact, a guy by the name of the Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani in Iraq is himself an Iranian. He is the chief Shiite cleric in Iraq. So there's many people who believe that the democratic government that is emerging in Iraq is going to be more or less the puppet of a Shiite regime in Iran. There's political connections there. There's monetary connections there. So the chaos in Iraq is directly benefiting the ruling mullahs of Iran.
In fact, the balance of power in the region between Iraq and Iran, which, by the way, was encouraged into war by the United States, where Iraq was our client state in the past to stop Iran, has now collapsed completely. In fact, Iran has no border enemy, nothing to worry about.
No, nothing at all.
Wow.
And you might be said as looking to even improve its lot. So This is from the New York Times over the weekend. President Bush Saturday again blamed Hezbollah for the crisis, but said responsibility must also be shared by Syria and Iran, which support and provide weapons to the militant Shiite Muslim political and military organization. Their actions threaten the entire Middle East and stand in the way of resolving the current crisis and bringing lasting peace to this troubled region, the president said in his weekly radio address from his ranch in Crawford, Texas. Bush said again that the United States is pressuring Israel to use care, quote, to protect innocent lives, and is concerned that the warfare is putting Lebanon's democratic government in peril.
Well, duh.
Right. So he's saying innocents are being killed, the democratic government is imperiled, but go Israel, go.
Yes, so it would seem. And it's like, you know, this was a very under-pressure region,
mm-hmm.
and the U.S. went and ripped the lid off.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And this also from the Times. The Bush administration is rushing a delivery of precision-guided bombs to Israel.
Yay!
Which requested the expedited shipment last week after beating its air campaign against Hezbollah targets in Lebanon.
Because they're running out of bombs.
That's... yeah. Exactly.
I'm sorry.
Hey, we're waging an air war, United States. We need more bombs.
Yeah.
So it's widely believed that Iran is supplying weapons, laser-guided missiles and such, to Hezbollah. It's widely believed that Iran is supplying weapons, probably not laser-guided missiles, to warring factions in Iraq, and really is sitting back and reaping the benefits of all the chaos that the United States and its ally Israel are sowing in the region. And why necessarily are we worried about Iran wielding more influence? Well, because it's a particularly oppressive sort of regime there and doesn't bode well for any of the things we ostensibly believe ought to take place in the Middle East, like the larger liberation of women, the flourishing of democracy, all those sorts of things.
Cheap oil.
Cheap oil, yeah.
All right, 231-8187. Gosh, oh, golly, we have this delay thing that we put in. Gosh, oh, golly, that's mm-hmm. my new kind of way of talking. And it creates certain kinds of problems for our listeners. So, oh, dear, what to say about that? I guess we'll just keep trying, and eventually we will try to get around to your phone calls.
I suppose. How are we doing? Eduardo, can we get somebody on the phone?
Well, Eduardo's on the phone himself.
On the phone himself.
He may be talking to Melanie Sloan, who's coming up shortly.
Yeah, she's coming. We're going to
it's kind of challenging.
Tom DeLay's trials and tribulations.
Oh, Tom DeLay. We keep beating on poor Tom.
Well, yeah, because it makes me happy to beat on poor Tom.
Well, you know, I mean, there's so little that makes one happy these days. We have to go for poor Tom, you know.
Yeah.
I guess I want to come back very briefly to this question of, wait a minute, maybe we can get a caller in. Do we have time for a caller before Melanie? Yeah, let's get a caller in.
Okay.
All right, we're going to do this.
All right, who do we have?
All right. No.
No, what? No
yeah,
caller.
Yeah, we don't know. Yes. Oh, hi. Hello, who are you?
I'm just listening to your radio talk show.
Oh, well, good, good.
But you're on the air, I should warn you. Thousands of people are now listening to your words.
Say what?
You're on the air. Go ahead.
Well, I happen to be an Israeli, and I'm listening to all of this, and... I wonder a little bit about a tone.
Sure, go ahead.
I'm not exactly a Bush supporter or the war in Iraq.
Uh-huh.
But I think you're making fun of the basics. And I'd like to hear how do you guys actually... suppose that a solution or peace could come to the region.
No, I think that's a very, very good and as you point out, very difficult question. But I want to go back to the suggestion that we're just being too glib or humorous or something. I think what you're hearing is a certain kind of sadness and bitterness turning into humor. I personally don't find any happiness in the situation at all. So I just wanted to clear that up with you.
And as to what we can do to bring peace to the region, that's, I think, might be as close to as an intractable problem as we see anywhere on the globe right now. You've got a region where every government in the area is, to one degree or another, influenced by religion. And that is just an unwise situation. a Jewish state surrounding Muslim states, both of them or all of them having some sort of religious interest in the area. What are you going to do?
Well, and beyond that, it's not a question so much of religion as fundamentalism within the context of each of those religions that is particularly troubling. As you know, as an Israeli, you're probably much more aware of this than I am. There has been a shift in Israeli politics over the years, largely, I think, brought about by the unremitting struggle by the Palestinians in response to what is an unremitting struggle by Israel to limit the Palestinians. Now, where I think many Israelis and I would split, and many American Zionists would split, would disagree with each other, is in the role of Israel in all of this. My criticism, and I've been very reluctant to make it over the years, but this war, this most recent war, has kind of tipped me over the edge on it, is that Israel essentially, first of all, never wanted a single state solution, and more important than that, and I'm not talking about the Palestinians here, they're also guilty in this matter, but more than that, the fact of the matter is that Israel has made sure that there is no possibility of a viable Palestinian state. The water disappears, the arable land disappears, the places to work disappear, armies go in into areas where alleged terrorists exist and smash whole neighborhoods and so on. But we're going to drop this topic for now because coming up right now from Washington, D.C. is Melanie Sloan.
Good morning, Melanie.
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Hi.
Hi. How are you? It's been a while.
It has been a while.
I'm glad you're back.
It's nice to be back.
So good times for Tom DeLay, huh?
You know, well, bad times for Tom DeLay, good times for the rest of us.
Ah, yes.
So essentially his political action committee has been dismantled, and along with it, the apparatus for raising money that he's used.
That's right. His longtime PAC, Americans for Republican Majority, or ARMPAC, was just reached what they call a conciliation agreement with the Federal Election Commission, or the FEC. And under the terms of it, ARMPAC will pay one of the largest fines in FEC history, $115,000, and will shut down.
So what did ARMPAC do that was illegal?
ARMPAC did a lot of things that were illegal. They failed to report more than $322,000 in debts and other obligations to vendors, and misrepresented more than $240,000 in other financial activity. And they also misallocated money between the federal and the non-federal arm of ARMPAC. So they were using federal money they were using soft money, basically, which is corporate or union funds, illegally.
Hmm. And ARMPAC essentially was the money, or the means of supplying the money that drove the DeLay part of the whole DeLay Abramoff Norquist axis in Washington.
That's right. ARMPAC was an incredibly powerful PAC, one of the richest PACs in Washington in years. And as we all know, in Washington, the power is all centered in the money. And the main reason that Tom DeLay was so powerful was because he managed to pull in so much money and then give so much money away to other members of Congress, which kept them loyal.
And this is what they generally call soft money.
No, that would generally have been hard money.
Oh, these are direct political.
And a lot of hard money, and then hand it out to other congressional members of Congress who could then use it in their campaigns. And that would be only you could use hard dollars for that. Which basically means money that didn't come from corporations or unions. Not that Tom DeLay was ever really a beneficiary of unions, the benefit of being able to pull in that kind of money is to give it to your compatriots in the House.
Well, does this mean I'm asking you for a prediction here. Are we beginning to see the crumbling of the machine that essentially powered this Congress in the interest of this neo-fascist or proto-fascist group that are the current administration?
I think we have seen the dismantling of it. I mean, I think it started with the ethics complaint that Crewe wrote against Tom DeLay 2 years ago now, when the ethics committee condemned Mr. DeLay for his actions, and then eventually he was indicted down in Texas for misusing a state PAC, Texans for a Republican Majority, and then he was forced to, in fact, resign from Congress, and now his main source of income, ARM PAC, is now out of business. So I think this is the, you know, yet another nail in Tom DeLay's coffin.
Now, is this something that's going to be used against him in the trial in Texas?
You know, it could well be used against him in the trial in Texas. The trial in Texas is all about whether Tom DeLay knowingly misused federal corporate money for state races in Texas. And you're not allowed to use corporate money in Texas state races either, just like you can't use it in federal races. And I would, if I were Ronnie Earle, the Travis County District Attorney, I would bring in this evidence that he was misusing ARM PAC's money as evidence that there was a pattern of Mr. DeLay's illegal behavior. And that's the kind of thing that can be admitted as evidence to show a pattern. I would expect there will be pre-trial motions about that because DeLay will obviously want that evidence excluded.
You know, I look at this, Melanie, in a larger context. I see that the current administration has essentially packed the courts and is close to packing, totally controlling the Supreme Court. It has packed the Congress by processes such as the DeLay process. It has, and by the exchanges of money, made sure that all the Republicans toe this peculiar line, which has not essentially always been the Republican position. And then, of course, there is this willful Cheney-Bush, I guess Cheney-Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, et cetera, foreign and domestic policy, all of which seem to me to point to the creation of a kind of imperium, a kind of fascism in which American opinion is oppressed and which the whole world is supposed to be driven towards some kind of what is euphemistically called democracy, but in fact is essentially service to the United States and particularly to certain interests like the oil industry. My question is this, given the weakness of the Democratic Party, is this going to persevere despite the falling of DeLay and the crumbling of the credibility of the Bush administration?
Well, you know, I think we'll find out a little more about that in November. We'll see how the American people feel now that they've been subject to all of this relentless sort of negativity by the Bush administration and by the Republican Congress and all the corrupt activity. Hmm. Between the corruption and the incompetence, I think the American people may have finally had enough.
Well, what are the Democrats doing to exploit the situation? Anything?
Well, you know, the Democrats stink. What can I say? The Democrats never managed to find an opportunity they can't miss. And I think how does that saying go? They can always manage to snatch defeat out of the jaws of victory.
But it sounds like you're not very hopeful even now.
I'm not very hopeful because I don't think the Democrats capitalize on these issues very well. I don't think they bring home to the American people what this means to them, why corruption is bad for them, how having somebody like Tom DeLay in Congress has hurt the American people. And I think there are so many concrete examples of it. I mean, for example, you know, we see things like the energy bill, which luckily seems to be going nowhere, which has all sorts of terrible provisions that are just bought and paid for by energy companies. And we saw that with the Medicare Prescription Drug Act 2 years ago, which was completely bought and paid for by the pharmaceutical companies and was terrible for the American public. And I don't think that the Democrats have managed to really bring that point home.
Well, is this, you know, I'm focusing on the Democrats because they are apparently the only party of resistance, however horrible they are. Is this, and a lot of our listeners would assume, is this simply a conspiracy in which the Democrats play the loyal opposition and don't do much? Or is there really some stuff to the Democrats? I'm finding a euphemism I can use in daytime radio. Some courage there that they simply haven't quite tapped yet? Or is it really all over? I mean, you're seeming to suggest it might be.
Well, I think that the Democrats may find themselves back in power, but really no thanks to their own efforts, just because they have to just stay out of the way of the Republicans who are just constantly shooting themselves in the feet.
Or in the head, as in the case of Cheney.
Or in the head, that's right. I mean, I think that there's just, you know, so much of this corruption and incompetence comes out daily that I don't know that in some ways, and Americans can't help but read about, you know, the terrible things going on in Iraq, the, you know, this administration's total lack of any kind of coherent foreign policy anywhere. You can't help but read all of that and be worried, even if you don't think the Democrats have an answer.
But there is an irony here, I think, which is that what this also does is it convinces the American people of the unworthiness or the lack of importance of voting or even considering the government as a legitimate force. And that tends to drive people away from the polls, I think. And it also tends to make them have lower expectations and therefore more willing to accept corruption in the long run. And that's what's really troubling me. Essentially, Americans have come to the position where they're not looking to the government to help them solve any problems.
Well, that does worry me, and, you know, in some sense, we got the government we deserve. If we're not going to get out there and vote, then, you know, we can't really be held to complain all that much about what they're doing here in Washington.
Yeah, but how can you vote when the opposition doesn't have much opposition to it?
Well, then I think it's your job as a citizen of the United States to go out and find a candidate who does.
So,
amen to that.
Amen to that. what's your immediate prediction for the... For the near image, do you actually think the Democrats will win in November? And do you think that this administration is simply going to go down in history as one of the worst in our history?
Oh, I absolutely think this administration will go down as one of the worst in our nation's history. I think there's very little doubt about it. I think they have just left us with this mess in the Middle East that who knows when will be, you know, if who knows what will happen there. And I think the corruption in Congress is just a legion, and we hear more and more about it all the time. You know, Jerry Lewis, who's the chairman of the Appropriations Committee, is the latest member of Congress under federal investigation. I think in 2007 we'll be learning a lot more about Jerry Lewis's activities. But I do think because of all of these kind of issues and the Republican Congress's relentless support of Bush no matter what and their failure to engage in any kind of oversight and the corruption issues, I think the Democrats will take over the House in November.
So what are you working on right now? What is your strategy, your organization's and yours?
You know, our strategy is what it always is, to pick off the corrupt members of Congress. And we'll keep doing that. We've been working on a member from North Carolina, a man named Charles Taylor, who owns a bank in North Carolina and another bank in Russia, and has been involved in some very questionable financial activities. And we are we've been working hard at finding more information out about Jerry Lewis, as I said, the chairman of the Appropriations
Committee. This is not the telephone guy.
Not the telephone guy. This is literally one of the most powerful members of the House of Representatives, the chairman of Appropriations. And what it turns out to have happened is he has a good friend, a man named Bill Lowry, who used to be a congressman but lost his seat to no one else than Duke Cunningham in an ethics scandal, funnily enough. But anyway, Bill Lowry became a lobbyist, and then it turns out that if you want to get an appropriation from Jerry Lewis, you have to go through Bill Lowry, the lobbyist, and pay him. And then Bill Lowry, in return, and his clients all pay for Jerry Lewis's campaigns. And finally, federal investigators are looking into that matter.
So on top of the ideological kind of peculiar fascism that has evolved in this administration, on top of that, and I'm going to say this because I can't help but say it, not unlike the Nazi era, you then get a kind of corruption within the structure of the true believers. Is that right?
Well, there's so much corruption in the Congress, but I really lay this at Tom DeLay's feet. He institutionalized corruption. He made it perfectly acceptable to demand money in return for legislative assistance. And, you know, that previously we called that bribery and extortion.
Well, let me ask you this then. If you took a snapshot right now of the DeLay, Abramoff, Norquist money machine, how is that functioning right now? Is there still that same quid pro quo going on, even though there's so many of its prominent members have either been indicted or ended up in jail?
I'm sure that it is still going on. We just don't know where all the money moved to. It's not going through Norquist right now. It's going through somebody else, but I feel sure it's still traveling.
So there's still plenty of work for you to do.
Has it seemed to you like Washington's all cleaned up lately?
No, but I imagine you're feeling you guys are feeling no small amount of personal satisfaction here. It seems that your efforts have really borne fruit of late.
You know, I really do feel pleased by that, and I'm glad that Tom DeLay is gone because he really was terrible for our democracy. I mean, he just was all the worst of our system of government. And I have a lot of hope for the future, but, you know, it's kind of sad that you have to keep plugging away at it day after day after day because there's always going to be some member of Congress willing to sell his position for money.
So I guess first of all, I want to thank you for the work you do, but I also wanted to urge you not only to continue on with this, but to start looking at the issues of corruption having to do with war making. Because I have a funny feeling that what we need to talk about more is the, for example, the Halliburton thing, stuff like that. And I'm hoping that there's a process underway where you'll be able to catch that in the congressional context.
You know, that's something that's really hard to go through to look at Congress over. But what we another part of what we do here at CRU is we send out Freedom of Information Act requests, which are ways that you can ask government agencies for information, and then when they fail to give it to you, you can sue them.
Uh-huh.
And so, for example, we are in court with the Department of Homeland Security, for example, over documents related to the government's incompetence related to Katrina, and we are looking at doing another FOIA regarding contracting abuses, which seems so legion in this administration. So there is a way to go after the administration for that kind of thing.
So that's pretty much how it works. You ask them for the information, they don't give it to you, and then you sue them.
That's right.
That's
and you find yourself in federal court.
Oh, okay.
Melanie, I guess we should let you go now. But I really want to appreciate your. I want to express my appreciation for your being here with us. Hope we continue this relationship.
It's always my pleasure to appear.
And I also want to once again thank you for the work you do and wish you well.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the kind words.
Thank you, Melanie.
Melanie Sloan, Washington,
yep.
D.C.
Center for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington.
Hey,
Citizens for Responsibility.
Yeah, Citizens. I got to tell people, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial. It is talk radio with me. I'm Joe Uris. That's Abe Proctor. The number to call is 231-8187. On the table today, the unending and horrible war in Lebanon, and the issue of the embryos, the 400,000, is it?
Yep, 400,000 unadopted embryos.
Unadopted embryos. I think we should adopt a couple.
How do you adopt an embryo?
Well, you could put it in a petri dish and put it in your pocket.
That's true.
You know, it's like your coat pocket.
You just leave it in your freezer?
No. Well, I guess you could leave it in your freezer until some likely lady. You know, this is a really interesting thing about these. These embryos are nothing without a woman.
Right.
So you have to go and find 400,000 women who are anxious to have these embryos implanted.
Right. And carry them to term and deliver them.
And then that would be saving these lives.
Right. So to recap the president's position. It's murder to use these embryos for stem cell-related research.
Yes.
But it's not murder to throw them in the trash.
Well, that makes perfect sense.
Sure.
I can understand that.
Yeah. Because he's part of the culture of life.
But, you know, I do want to revisit the unavoidable horrors of what's happening in Lebanon and a couple of three things that really need to be made clear. I think Israel has legitimate grievances against terrorists, particularly suicide bombers. And I think that these are horrible crimes that are being committed. I do not excuse them, but I do think they're understandable in the context of the struggles that are going on. The difference between excusing and understanding is important. That's number one. Number two, I do believe that the Israeli response to Hezbollah's behavior of late is disproportionately brutal and disproportionately horrific and disproportionately murderous. And I think that anyone who's concerned for the survival of Israel should be able and willing and by necessity, if they're morally concerned, able to speak out on this issue. It's important. This is something that can't be denied and it needs to be understood and appreciated by all communities.
All right, well, if you're going to toss around things like disproportionality, let's look at that for a moment. This offensive is nominally in response for the kidnapping of two Israeli soldiers.
Yes.
By members of Hezbollah. So what, in your opinion, would be a proportionate response? What, do you go nab a couple Hezbollah militiamen?
I suppose. I mean, the whole thing is so absurdly awful.
Well, see, that's why I think there's something else going on here. I mean, we can talk all we want about disproportionality. They were never interested in a quote-unquote proportional response. It would, if I had to hazard a guess, I would think that this the Israeli government has long wanted to press into Lebanon and long wanted to pull out the cork and rain down destruction on Hezbollah.
Well, and then there's other elements. There's the internal politics of Israel itself, the current ruling group. Gosh, I just forgot the woman's name, who's the power behind the throne, who was Sharon's kind of amanuensis. And I apologize for that, but she is often appearing on television and very clear in her support for what's going on. The new head of Israel essentially has got to prove his mettle, as it were, and this is the opportunity to do that. I don't know. I haven't seen any real survey research. I don't think a majority of the Israeli people probably support this action, but I actually don't know. And I do know that now they're calling up the reserves. The United States is essentially egging them on, providing more smart bombs, as they're called. This is a very ugly situation. Any other administration, any other European Union, any other nations in the world would be hurrying to urge an end to the conflict, an armistice, some kind of at least a temporary cessation of hostilities so conversation can take place. But apparently that's not what's happening right now at all.
Agreed. This administration has yet to call for a ceasefire, has yet to do anything but recommend the deployment of some international force under the auspices of some international body to man the border between Israel and Lebanon. That's really as far as we've gotten diplomatically in this situation.
Well, and then we have Condoleezza Rice assuring everyone that she's not going to ask the Israelis to stop doing what they're doing. And here's what's really troubling me. The American media slavishly following the line that the Israeli action is in some way proportionate to the Hezbollah action, focusing on the fighting at the border, even though it shows much of the destruction of Lebanon and Lebanon's cities and the misery of the Lebanese people, up to 800,000 people displaced now, even though it focuses on that, it also gives equal time, as though it were equally significant, to the horrible but far less awful, I have to say, bombings, the rocketry that strikes the Israeli cities. And the whole tone of all of the major news outlets has been sort of as if this is some kind of regrettable but equal conflict, which is perfectly understandable, and somehow the bombings and attacks on Lebanon are a reasonable retribution for the attacks by Hezbollah. And I can't see it. I just can't see it. Anyway, that's why I'm upset.
And there's another aspect of this which can't be overlooked, and that is after the attacks of September 11, 2001, when Osama bin Laden stated the reasons that his organization launched those attacks, the most prominent was the United States' unquestioning support of Israel and its repressive apartheid tactics against the Palestinians.
See, I absolutely believe in the right of Israel to exist, and I think that there has to be a peace resolved in the region. But I also believe in the right of the Palestinian people to exist in a viable way. And since a single-state solution seems impossible, a two-state solution is inevitable. But what's been done with the wall and where it goes and so on, hardly is that, plus Israel at will, goes into the Palestinian territories to punish people who are, in fact, behaving in criminal manner, and some of whom are quite innocent. Anyway, we've got lots of callers. It is, after all, talk radio. This is, after all, KBOO 90.7, your FM dial. Let's take some of those calls. 231-8187. Paul, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You know, I agree with so much of what you say today, but I think you made a big mistake near the beginning of the show, so I need to beat you over the head with it.
It's very possible.
You said that Hezbollah is a legitimate organization because they occupy seats in the parliament.
Yes.
Well, you know, saying that is a little bit like saying that it'd be all right for the Republican Party to raise an army and then go up and pick on Canadians.
Well, now that's a good point, actually. I think you're making a good point. I have to agree with you there.
And then take money from other countries to do so. And anyhow, I think this really is a terrible situation, and what we really need to be doing is we really need to be looking for solutions that we can spread around and try and get something going, because it's hard. It's impossible for me to see any really great deal. Just everybody is in a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation.
No, and I do want to speak to your earlier point. I think you're right. I think I'm being a little glib there. And but I do think that the other part of that was that Hezbollah was a creation of the original Israeli invasion of Lebanon.
But you know, anytime there's a conflict like that, there's always two sides,
or at least two sides.
And the situation we're in right now is that there is no workable agreement between, you know, there's no way to bring these sides, take them anywhere. Not even, I'm not expecting to get them together, but we should at least expect that all of the sides that are really involved are kind of state-oriented groups.
It would be good if in fact the politics of the region followed the pattern of classic nation states in struggle. But the reality is that this is no longer the case at all. And it may not have been so much the case in the past, and we just didn't recognize it. I do think that the United States is criminally responsible for encouraging encouraging these wars, and with this notion of creating democracy all over the Middle East, and is criminally responsible for not involving itself, give Clinton credit where credit's due, in trying to at least reduce the tension levels rather than encouraging it. I mean, the sending over of these bombs is just, you know, horrendous.
Well, one analogy that I have thought of is that Israel right now is like a beekeeper that's surrounded by beehives, and the United States came over and started pounding on the top of the beehives with baseball bats.
That's a good analogy.
That's a very good analogy.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for the call.
And you're right. Something has to be done about those Republicans in Canada.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Paul. Let me touch on those bombs being sent by the United States to Israel.
Sure.
I didn't really finish up that thought when I talked about it before. This from the same New York Times article. Also, go ahead and read the excerpt I read before. The Bush administration is rushing a delivery of precision-guided bombs to Israel, which requested the expedited shipment last week after beginning its air campaign against Hezbollah targets in Lebanon, American officials said Friday. The decision to quickly ship the weapons to Israel was made with relatively little debate within the Bush administration, the officials said. Its disclosure threatens to anger Arab governments and others because of the appearance that the United States is actively aiding the Israeli bombing campaign in a way that could be compared to Iran's efforts to arm and resupply Hezbollah. Well, if that's the no-brainer to end all no-brainers, don't you think?
Is. No, it really is. And the U.S. at least should have created the fiction of trying to be...
No, it shouldn't have created any fictions. It shouldn't be sending precision-guided bombs to Israel, period.
I agree with you. But at least part of the fiction would be not to send the bombs and to say, hey, boys, please, don't fight. And this is not at all what we're doing. What we're actually saying is, let's you and him have a big fight.
Yeah, that's exactly what's going on. So far, both Condi Rice and the president have said that any solution in the region has to include the participation of Syria, but so far is refusing to speak to Syria in any way. So what we have basically is a lot of lip service. The president saying he's worried about the deaths of innocents in Lebanon, he's worried about the fragile democratic government in Lebanon, but he's not doing anything to rein in the Israelis, nor is he bringing anyone to the table whom he says needs to come to the table.
And, of course, in the larger sense, we've all known for years now that it wasn't just Iraq that was the target of this administration. They were very interested in Iran. They were very interested in Syria. And this may be the beginning of the opportunity that this administration is seeking to womp on Syria.
Right, quite possibly. And the point I was trying to get at a few minutes ago when I said that the principal reason behind the September 11th attacks in the minds of al-Qaeda was the United States' unfettered support for Israel. Mm-hmm. What's going to happen now that the United States is completely backing an air and ground offensive into a neighboring Arab country? And what's going to happen now?
Well, I don't know.
I don't know.
Nothing good.
I don't know.
All right, let's hear from our listeners. 231-8187.
Hello.
Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
What's your name?
My name is Dave.
Good morning.
I want to preface this a little.
Okay.
Before another caller decides to call up and accuse me of being an anti-Semite or the biggest crock of all, a quote-unquote self-hating Jew, I am Jewish. I know the history of the 20th century pretty well, and my father was a European theater World War II vet.
And you don't hate yourself?
No.
Okay.
Israel needs to get over the freaking Holocaust. I believe that Israel is acting like an abused and traumatized child that won't turn on their parent, but that has to strike out at somebody. And that's where the disproportionate responses, which they do have a history of, come from.
So you see it as a kind of a psychosocial phenomenon.
Oh, yeah, partly. I buy your idea about our administration looking at this as a possible golden opportunity. But I think the disproportionality of the responses, you know, never again, the idea of killing one for every, you know, 100 for every Israeli that drop, this is maybe an older idea. And a book recommendation, scattergunning all over the place today, the book that gave me my first capsule history of Israel, and later I found out was fairly accurate, was a pop novel from the early 60s called Exodus by Leon Uris.
Of all things.
That followed the history of Jewish migration from Europe to Palestine in the late 19th century and the formation of the Israeli government and Israeli military.
But do you really think the response by the Israelis towards Lebanon, is that, you think, because of lingering psychological baggage from the Holocaust?
I think there still is some of that. I think the best Israel's best years, if it survives, are ahead, and they'll start when all the generation of leaders that experienced the Holocaust firsthand, either as survivors of it or as Palestinian settlers during that time, when they die off or retire. And it's seeing as how many World War II veterans in this country are still alive, that's that era is coming. It won't be very long.
Hmm. Well, thank you very much for the call.
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate you listening.
Yeah, you know, the voice I'm not hearing, and I've said this earlier, and I really would welcome it, would be a Zionist position. We're not hearing that. And I might disagree with it, but I think it's important.
Well, why don't you clarify for us what you mean by Zionist position?
Good point. Well, Zionism is, of course, the movement founded in late 19th century, that is the 1800s, to establish a homeland for the Jews in then Palestine. That movement culminated in the creation of the State of Israel after the discovery of the horrors of the Holocaust in Europe. The Arab peoples saw this as an unfair infliction upon them, because they perceived those lands, which were the old holy lands, as their own territory and part of their holy space, as it were. Zionism is the movement which puts forward the idea that this homeland for the Jews is a place where all Jews should at least visit, if not stay, and that it is their right, historic right, and now has taken on a certain religious quality among some fundamentalist Jewish people as the greater Israel, as an area which is given by God to the Jewish people. So Zionism has both a nationalist element, that is, the Jewish people will always be persecuted unless they have their own home and their own way to build a society, and this is the place it should be, which is then the religious aspect, which is that this is the God-given land promised to Moses in Exodus.
Now, I think that God-given notion, it's that is the single largest obstacle towards any lasting peace in the area. As long as Israel believes itself in some way, shape, or form, to some degree or other, entitled biblically, religiously, to that land, we're never going to be able to see a truly secular, truly participatory government there that values both Jews and Muslims and Christians as equal voices in government.
Well, it becomes very confused, because indeed it is, as you have pointed out many more times than I, a Jewish state. And the problem that I see is, and I agree with you on this, is that nation states are best governed by a non-religious system. And
absolutely.
And the
and that's just not a conceit we say as Americans.
No.
I think that's a truth.
No, I think it's a truth. And I think that this represents a serious problem. It would have been wonderful, and I don't think it will ever in our lifetimes, probably never happen, to have turned that region into part of what was then Transjordan, now part of Jordan, part of all of Israel, and so on, into a state which would be a secular state. But geopolitically, realistically, from the point of view of the Zionist community, that can't happen precisely because the number of Palestinians would quickly outnumber the number of Jews.
All right, well, speaking of the confluence of religion and governance, I'm going to give you a quote here and see if you can tell me who this is. Okay?
Yeah.
All right, it's a quiz. All right, everybody listening?
I'm going to flunk.
This is the quote. God told me to strike at Al-Qaeda, and I struck them. And then he instructed me to strike at Saddam, which I did. And now I am determined to solve the problem in the Middle East.
I know who it is.
Who?
It's a crazy man, and he's in the White House.
That's
and his name is George W. Bush.
Yep.
Ah! Let's go to the board. 231-8187, looking for a Zionist. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, fellas. I'm sorry I'm not a Zionist.
Oh, well.
Oh, that's quite all right.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Jesus is coming. Look busy. I just wanted to add
if he came, he'd be so mad.
Jesus is coming. Hide your smoke.
Yeah, Jesus is PO'd, exactly. Now, just a couple of notes of levity. You remember the old line, would you like to come up and see my etchings? Remember that line?
Well, I'm not old enough to remember that line. It's more like, you want to watch my filthy video or something.
Lady, would you like to come up and see my etchings?
I got it.
And, of course, the New Yorker cartoon took that a twist further and has the boy and the girl on the porch, and the boy says to the girl, wait right here, I'll bring my etchings down. But the real funny one is, would you like to come up and see my embryos?
Okay. All right.
A little levity. They're in the freezer. They've got to stay in the freezer. And why don't we just give all of these embryos, all 400,000, and we could solve all kinds of problems if we allow gay couples to adopt. And there it is. There's 400,000 waiting.
Well, wait a minute. That would only work for the lady gays.
Ooh. You understand,
right. There's a woman has to be involved in this process.
Yeah, we have not invented an artificial womb, and thank God for that.
Well, there you go. All right, thanks a lot for the call, man.
Thanks.
All right, 231-8187. Jay, you're on the
Jay.
Air.
We're rapidly falling to pieces here. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Jay.
Hello. Israel, like any sovereign nation, can't have their sovereignty violated by having people firing rockets at them.
Mm-hmm. No, that's true.
Kidnapping their soldiers.
This is true.
But I do think that destroying the infrastructure of Lebanon was very, very destructive and also foolish. I think that if Ariel Sharon had been alive, he is alive, but if he was in control, he probably would have done what he'd done in the past as of doing a prisoner exchange and then making a ground intrusion into southern Lebanon to try to root out Hezbollah without destroying the rest of Lebanon. But the thing that I want to bring up that's a little bit different than what has been talked about is I think that Israel is putting themselves in a great peril of basically having only one ally, the United States, because the United States has a long record of double-crossing its allies, Iraq, Iran, Haiti, Dominican Republic, Panama. It just goes on and on, and it wouldn't take too much. Israel wouldn't have to make a real big screw-up to turn the U.S. against them. And I know they have been trying to develop other allies, and I think they would be wise to do that. I think they're putting themselves in a perilous position. Mm.
I think you're making an interesting point. Israel, in fact, does do a great deal of business with Europe and with other nations as well in Asia and elsewhere. But, I think that the dependence, the interdependence, the codependence, that's the word, of the United States and Israel. Some have even argued, and I do not agree with this, that Israel is the tail wagging the dog of the United States. I don't think so. I think Israel is essentially a client state of the United States, That is clearly perceived as the case among most of the Islamic peoples of the world and many peoples outside of the Islamic world. So I do think that it is a very dangerous thing in that sense, but it's also, as you suggest, risky to depend on the United States because it can tend to be a fair-weather friend. But I want to thank you a lot for the call, man.
Yeah, I also wanted to say that I think that the Arabic world and then a lot of other people that are antagonistic towards Israel should get over the idea that Israel's going to disappear, because that's not going to happen.
Well, I hope it's not going to happen.
They're a very powerful country, and they're going to be there. So, a lot of this stuff coming from the Arabs is anti-Semitism. It's just it's stuff that would not be tolerated in our culture, like in Kuwait, they have children cartoons, about the dumb Jew, the fat Jew. All the comical, stupid characters are Jews. And this goes on all through the Arabic world. This is certainly, a very, very childish behavior, and they need to straighten out their act on that.
No, I agree with you. I think the scapegoating of Jews in the Arab world, in fact, in Japan also, is really quite weird and disgusting. I mentioned on the show last week that the head of the new government, of the legislature of the new government of Iraq, was suggesting that all the troubles that are happening in Iraq were somehow the responsibility of Jews. So there is a kind of, there is a kind of madness afoot in this respect, and it is clearly anti-Semitic, and it is clearly dysfunctional, and it is clearly dangerous, and it must stop.
Like I hear a lot of particularly liberals spending a lot of time, and I've done it myself, bemoaning the fact of the genocide of the American Indian. Hey, that's all over, That happened. That's the way it is now. In fact, I was carrying on a dialogue that to my daughter, and she says, well, that stuff's true, but I'm not giving up my home, injustices happen, but then they become part of reality.
Okay, well, listen, I want to give some others an opportunity. Thank you very much for the call. All right, 231-8187.
Who do we have next, Eduardo?
We don't.
We don't.
We've driven them all away. How cruel. How awful. I was hoping for there to be some really good discussion with someone who has a totally different position than the one you and I have on this Israeli incursion into Lebanon.
Someone who believes that Israel is acting well within its rights and is justified in what it's done.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm not capable of making that argument, even as an intellectual exercise.
Condi, if you're listening, give us a call.
231-8187. Condi is a power whore.
Oh. Well, we'll get into that at another time.
Another time, perhaps. Speaking of other times, I should tell our audience that I'm going to take a couple of months off.
Yeah, it's just going to be me.
Just going to be Abe. You won't have me to kick around anymore.
We'll be talking a lot about soccer, so prepare for
that. No, Abe's more than able, and it'll be a great show. And when I come back, we'll continue on where we left off. But we're not done yet today. No. We have another 20 minutes to go. And we have talked about the what's going on in Lebanon. I'm not sure that people appreciate the degree to which the United States is essentially egging Israel on in this, because it seems really clear to me. I was watching C-SPAN. I think I might have mentioned this last week, but I noticed that there was a program where the Russian leadership was discussing what kind of a role it could have in actually organizing a ceasefire in the region. Tony Blair now has repeatedly suggested that there needs to be a ceasefire. The European Union is anxious for a ceasefire.
The Lebanese government.
The Saudis, who love to hold hands with George Bush, showed up in Washington, was it yesterday or the day before, and said, "Oh, please, Georgie, let's have a ceasefire."
The only nation not to recommend a ceasefire, apparently, is the United States. I heard some talking heads over the weekend saying the reason we're doing that is because we figure, well, you know, any ceasefire that's brokered right now is probably going to last, you know, less than a year.
That would be good.
So, right. So why bother calling one? Because, you know, hey, those kids might as well die now rather than in, you know, 9 or 10 months. Right?
It's so disgusting.
It is disgusting.
It is. It's just, to me, it is so sad. And, you know, what's being ignored, of course, the way in which our press works inevitably ignores the fact that there are many people dying right now in another war, which I think has a little ceasefire right now. But it's another war over these kinds of issues in the Gaza Strip. You know, the Israelis have made incursions there.
An extension of the same conflict.
Yeah, basically. And they're taking prisoners and they're smashing buildings and they're doing a lot of harm to people's lives. And essentially that's going on. And, of course, as you may know, those of you listening to us, the death toll in the in the fighting in Iraq, while democracy flourishes, has risen enormously. People are dying on out of the Sunni communities and out of the Shia communities, and it's horrific. And the U.S. is incapable of doing anything about it, apparently. Yep. So, you know, so this is not just a failed policy in an abstract sense. What the United States has done here is tantamount to, well, genocide isn't the right word, but tantamount to allowing lots of people to murder each other for reasons that have that are really tangential to the interests of themselves and the rest of the world. It's pretty awful.
It is. And further, the support of the United States support of Israel's offensive in Lebanon right now is undermining the stated central purpose of our presence militarily and otherwise in the Middle East, which is to promote democracy. Lebanon is one of the few democratic governments around in that part of the world. And it's really, really in trouble right now. It's being invaded right now with the support of the United States.
It is interesting to see the response of Israelis on television to the fact that they're being bombed, well, being missiled. Is that a term, missiled?
Sure, it'll work.
Yeah. And their horror at the losses they're experiencing, which are minuscule, not that any loss of life is tolerable, but minuscule. compared to what the Lebanese people, most of whom have nothing to do with Hezbollah, are experiencing. And this is all, again, I've said this before, and it's really important. The American media has created the image of equivalency, that the horrors that are being visited upon the Israelis are the equivalent of the horrors that are being visited upon the Lebanese, or the horrors that are visited upon the Israelis are equivalent to the horrors visited upon the Palestinians, and so on. These are not equivalent, and the whole idea that there is some kind of equity in this struggle is wrong-hearted and wrong-headed and evil, actually evil. And the American media has just come right along on that, and it's just so saddening and so disgusting.
So really we have yet another intractable problem, one of which we're a major cause, and really that we can't do anything.
I don't think it's intractable. I think it's difficult, and I think that a permanent solution to these issues is only possible when the ambitions of the United States in the region are curtailed, and when in fact all of the nations that are really engaged in a variety of struggles over resources, particularly oil, are willing to sit down and talk the thing out and work out a quid pro quo that makes some sense to everybody involved, which must include the creation of a viable Palestinian state and a viable and safe Israeli state.
Well, there's one thing that's making me feel better about all this, and that is that George W. Bush is talking to God. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. This is KBOO 90.7 FM. This is Talk Radio. I'm Abe. That's Joe, who's busily reading something and probably is preparing an eloquent missive. Give us a call. We'd love to talk to you. We've got a little time left. Who do we have, Eduardo? Oh, nobody, apparently.
Well, actually, I was just handed a piece by Gandhi talking about the situation of the Jewish people in Germany. I guess this was, I don't know the date of this, but I'm guessing it was 1938. And I'm going to just read it. I don't know that I share these views, but it's interesting. Here's 1938. My sympathies are all with the Jews. I have known them intimately in South Africa. Some of them became lifelong companions. Through these friends, I have come to learn much of their age-long persecution. They have been the untouchables of Christianity. The parallel between their treatment by Christians and the treatment of untouchables by Hindus is very close. Religious sanction has been invoked in both cases for the justification of the inhuman treatment meted out to them. Apart from the friendships, therefore, there is the more common universal reason for my sympathy for the Jews. But my sympathy does not blind me to the requirement of justice. The cry for the national home for the Jews does not make much appeal to me. The sanction for it is sought in the Bible and the tenacity with which the Jews have hankered after return to Palestine. Why should they not, like other peoples of the earth, make that country their home, where they are born and where they earn their livelihood? Palestine, this is Gandhi speaking now, and I do not necessarily agree with all of his sentiments. Palestine belongs to the Arabs in the same sense that England belongs to the English or France to the French. It is wrong and inhuman to impose the Jews on the Arabs. What is going on in Palestine today cannot be justified by any moral code of conduct. The mandates have no sanction, he's speaking of the British mandate, but that of the last war. Surely it would be a crime against humanity to reduce the proud Arabs so that Palestine can be restored to the Jews partly or wholly as their national home. The nobler course would be to insist on a just treatment of the Jews wherever they are born and bred. The Jews born in France are French. The Jews have no home. If the Jews have no home in Palestine, will they relish the idea of being forced to leave the other parts of the world in which they are settled? Or do they want a double home where they can remain at will? The cry for the national home affords a colorable justification for the German expulsion of the Jews. This is interesting stuff from 1938. The whole question of Zionism and the legitimacy of the Jewish state in the Zionist context is a difficult one. Gandhi's responding outside of the pale of the struggle of the Jewish people, while he clearly has empathy. And of course, if we look at the situation between Pakistan and now Bangladesh and India, we can see that Gandhi was actually killed by a Hindu fundamentalist who objected to his support for and opposition to the creation of a separate Muslim state, which became Pakistan. You know, so this whole thing is it's not about the Jews, and it's not about the Arabs. It's not about the Pakistanis, and it's not about the Indians. It's about a kind of persecution and injustice that has its roots, excuse roots, in religious traditions, and its real roots in opportunism and a kind of ugly nationalism. And unfortunately, in history, these things tend to repeat themselves in a variety of ways in a variety of contexts. So I don't know. I mean, I don't particularly have any great sympathy for Gandhi's position of 1938 as it relates to today, but I do understand where he was coming from at the time.
Sure.
And it further depresses me in all of this.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot that's uplifting about this, is there?
No, there really isn't. And I want to reiterate.
Except that God is talking to George W. Bush.
Yeah, that makes reassures me a lot. I notice people on the street that God talks to. Although they may be on a cell phone, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, but they're not commanders of the military.
Well, they think they are. No, anyway, I do think one thing I want to establish for us all is at this point, historically and realistically, in much the same way that the French have the rights of France, Israel, at this point, must continue to exist. And there must be, as well, a viable Palestinian state. And this is something that should be a big goal for all of the powers of the world.
And it's my opinion that that's never going to happen until a decision is made on all parts to create a secular state in which religion has no bearing or only a symbolic bearing. Otherwise, more business as usual.
231-8187. Let's go out to Sherry. Hi, how are you?
Hi.
Good morning.
Okay, here's the deal, you guys. Everybody needs to read that entire essay by Gandhi, written in 1938, lays the situation out very well. There's been this revisionist history on behalf, I think the Holocaust made it easy for the settlers of Israel, the Jewish settlers of Israel, to turn this whole thing into, to bury the reality that while Hitler was doing what Hitler was doing, the European Jews who were settling and trying to establish the an Israeli state with the support of the British guns were ignoring the Holocaust, ignoring what was going, what Hitler was doing. When Jews from Germany got there to Israel, they said, "Yeah, we don't have time for that because we're busy settling the Israeli state." And because if they had had to look closer, they would realize they were doing the same thing to the Arab people. So that's a piece of this entire history that needs to get looked at, and Gandhi addresses that in that essay, and I think that needs to be looked at.
I haven't read the essay, so I can't really comment on it in its entirety.
Yeah, I am just saying, I think that that's really worth reading, and maybe you should get back to that in another show.
It's probably worthwhile, but I do. I also want to make one other point, that in World War II, there was a Palestinian brigade, so-called, of the British Army, which was basically a Jewish brigade, and they were very much involved in defeating Nazism. So I don't exactly buy the idea that the Jews in Palestine were indifferent, and that was a volunteer brigade, by the way. They were indifferent to the Holocaust.
Oh well, you know, that's fine. You want to believe that, but I
no, that's not a belief. That's a fact.
True, and I think Jews who arrived there from Germany just found that out. Were treated that way. And that's also documented, but it's buried information.
I
becomes part of the revisionism that, you know, like I heard on your show today, a caller called in, and I agree with him partly, and that the what's going on there is like this psychological condition of we are the persecuted, but also, of course, that can be used indefinitely to create a nationalist state.
Well, I think the development of Israeli nationalism has a lot to do with the persecution complex. I agree with that. The point I was trying to make was that I cannot speak to some putative history of the late 30s and 40s on the part of some German Jews who came to Palestine. I do know, as a fact, that there was a significant brigade of Jews who went from Palestine to Europe to fight the Nazis. And they played a major role in insisting, for example, at the concentration camps, that the Jews that were there be allowed to practice their religion, which was something that the Allies were trying to kind of curtail so that the Germans wouldn't rise up. So I don't buy the idea that there was a unanimity, and this is my point.
I didn't say unanimity, but okay. You can't deny that that's part of the history as well. And it wasn't this idea that Israel is somehow made up of all the people that came out of the German Holocaust.
Oh, I never meant to suggest that.
And and they had nationalist ambitions. And no. I think that essay by Gandhi is really worth reading. It gives the people a much better background in that whole time period. And, you know, the real point I'm trying to make is that often all human beings, we're all capable. Anytime, here's the danger. Anytime you think your group of people or you are not capable of the most hideous behavior, you're already in trouble.
That's probably true. Is probably a very good point. I guess this is something that we're not going to resolve right here and right now. I do think, though, that the question of Zionism itself, that is, the idea of a homeland for the Jews, surely you're not arguing it doesn't come out of the persecution experience of the Jewish people, primarily in Europe.
No, I'm arguing it does come out of that.
Okay.
And even before the German Holocaust.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I don't know if you heard our show last week, but we did talk about that. Anyway, thank you very much for the call. I will read the Gandhi essay, and we'll get back to you on it.
All right. Yeah, Gandhi's been known to have a thing or two to say.
Yeah, and also sometimes was full of it, but that's another issue. 231-8187.
Do we have time for another call here before the end?
Yeah, let's try to do it.
All right. Who do we have, Eduardo?
We have a busy signal.
We have a busy signal.
That's always a good sign.
Yeah, people are busy. It's good. It's good for people to be busy. Dan, good morning.
Yeah, I have something that came to mind here that I hardly hear anyone bring up in all these things, and that's isolationism, which I think would be a great thing for the United States of America.
You mean like the Republicans used to have?
Huh?
You mean like what used to be central to the Republican Party when they were really conservative?
What George Washington talked about in his farewell address.
Yeah, right.
Something like that, only I'm more extreme. We've got a huge country. We could just have our own economy here, trade with each other. We could have a wonderful life here without being involved in all the troubles of the world.
Well, that was what the Whigs wanted. That was what the American Whig Party wanted.
Well, part of the idea
called the American Plan.
We moved over here from Europe to get away from the crazy wars and everything that the Europeans were always getting themselves into. That was a real large part of American mentality. What brought this to mind, I'll read this real fast, is I was just reading a poem by Thomas Paine that was a famous song, I guess, back in Revolutionary days called Liberty Tree.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, you have to picture colonial days. It's just this passage. It says, beneath, it's talking about the Liberty Tree, okay, the Liberty. Beneath this fair branch, like the patriarchs of old, their bread in contentment they eat, unwearied with trouble of silver or gold, or the cares of the grand and the great. And when I saw that line, the cares of the grand and the great, now America wants to be this, it's the superpower, right? And get entangled, be the world's policeman, on and on and on. What do we need all this for? If the world, you know, the evil of the world is never going to go away, why can't we just isolate ourselves?
We won't get to answer your question. We won't be able to respond. We've run out of time.
Isolation.
All right. Thank you for the call.
All right, so we're out of time.
I'm going to have to tackle that next week.
Yeah, you're going to have to tackle that next week.
We're long past the time when we can be an isolationist nation.
Well, I agree.
But anyway. All right, well, you're going on vacation?
Yes.
So have fun.
I will.
I'll hold down the fort.
I'll just sit home and read.
All right, I'll try not to get us, you know, fined or kicked off the air.
Good idea, Abe. You stay tuned because lots of good stuff coming up.
All right, we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
A minute after 9 o'clock. This is KBOO Portland. Welcome to the Tuesday Radio Zine. First on Between the Covers, Jim Schumach interviews Portland writer Charles D'Ambrosio, author of The Dead Fish Museum, a collection of stories mostly set in the Pacific Northwest. At 9:30 on Words and Pictures, it's the annual Zine Symposium preview. Lonnie and Jim from PDX Zines will be in to take your calls and about self-publishing and how to participate in the event. We'll also hear from commentator Jay Thiemeyer. He'll review the book Outlaws of America, The Weather Underground and the Politics of Solidarity. At 10:30, Demay Roberts hosts Stage and Studio. She'll discuss Hamlet by Quintessence Language and Imagination Theater and Quick Jones's musical Spotlight. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, independent journalist Dar Jamail, who exposed how the U.S. used white phosphorus bombs in Iraq, says Israel is using the same tactic in Lebanon. Now let's go to Between the Covers.
Chance to breathe while sitting at a red light. You look around, reflecting on your life. Am I drinking too much? Should I keep going, lose the light that I love? You second glance when I'm coming to a rest.